Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you here. In this first hour of the program, we'll be talking about elder abuse, what we know about it, and how it is we try to address the problem, both here in the United States and also in Canada. And our guest for the program this morning comes from Canada and indeed is associated with the Canadian Center for Elder Law Studies. This is at University of British Columbia in Vancouver. She's the program director there. She also founded the upcoming peer-reviewed Canadian Journal of Elder Law and organized the first Canadian conference on elder law that was held last fall in October. She is here visiting the campus. She gave a talk yesterday. This is the Anne F. Baum Elder Law Lecture that was at the law school. And we're pleased that she could be here this morning with us to talk about this issue. Questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, people have questions, they should feel welcome to call. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Generally speaking, now I know that there are numbers. If you ask what's the scope of elder abuse, there are numbers, and I've seen all kinds of different numbers. And also, apparently, there is a real concern that the reported cases are only a fraction of the actual, that there's much more that happens than gets reported. Do you have a sense that there are some fairly reliable numbers?
Well, the numbers are also exponential. We look right now, and of course we talk about the aging demographic, and the demographics are about the same in Canada as the United States. And that's by about 2041, about one quarter of the both American and Canadian populations are going to be over the age of 65. So when we talk about numbers, you have to keep the demographic in mind because it's only going to get more so. We see all kinds of numbers, and it's important to know that some of these numbers are what goes into the criminal justice system, and they're much, much smaller than the numbers that are dealt with sort of more civilly. But the rough gauges are about 1 in 12 older adults are subject to some type of abuse, and that you have to imagine – there's a lot of hidden issues there. So we take that with a grain of salt. We think it's probably more.
And we are talking about a wide range of things here. It could be physical abuse, could be emotional. It could be somebody taking advantage of another person for financial gain. It could be an issue of neglect. It's a pretty wide range of things that we're talking about.
And it's not a closed list either. In the way of all rights, when people are thinking about these things, it becomes clear that there's new issues. One of the main new issues right now is chemical restraints. We're finding both in nursing homes in Canada and the United States, as around the world, that people are being given medications to keep them quiet, which may not be appropriate for their needs.
And so we're also talking here, and I guess when I think about abuse, I think about it sort of in the general context of domestic violence, something that would generally happen in a person's home, probably, and where the perpetrator probably would be someone related to that person. But you're also in this, you have to include people who are in being cared for in some kind of institution, like a nursing home, for example.
Well, that's right. The statistics say generally that most types of domestic violence, that elder abuse is traditionally a family issue. And there's a debate about whether or not there's such a thing, whether it's simply some other form of domestic violence. But no, we think that elder abuse has its own, if you will, paradigm. A lot of the abuse can take place in the financial arena. And some of it is under powers of attorney or other documents that people might use. And sometimes it's really very malicious and horrible in the way that all kinds of criminal behavior can be. Sometimes abuse is done in that gray area, and that's when people take advantage.
Well, and I also do wonder, I'm sure that cases differ from one moment to the next, about the motivation of perpetrators and whether it's in fact their intent, whether there is clear intent to hurt, or whether this is secondary to something else. And it could be a wide range of things. It could be the person actually did intend to victimize the other. But I can imagine there are a lot of cases where it's at least related to problems within the family. It could be stress. It could be someone who is trying to care for someone else and is severely stressed out by the experience and maybe doesn't set out to hurt that person, but in fact does.
Well, that's just right. And when we're looking at the area of elder abuse, you also have to understand the broader context. So if people are being left to care for older adults, for instance, who may have some type of vulnerability, and certainly that's not the case of most older adults. Most older adults are vibrant and active and engaged in the community, but certainly there are those who do experience frailty and vulnerability. If the correct social supports aren't there, then we have an increased amount of caregiver stress. It's devolved, if you will, down to the individual who simply may not be able to take care. So we need to look at the society question as well.
And I think that that's a really good point, because there is a larger issue here about how it is we think about aging, about the fact that often older individuals are maybe very isolated. They and their caretakers may be isolated, and that we don't have, and I'm sure it is the case here in the United States and probably very similar in Canada, that we don't have the kind of social institutional support that might make it easier for those people, that then might ultimately reduce the amount of abuse and problems that we see.
And some of it is education, too. There's a piece of that that's education. Certainly education of the doctors and the nurses and the professionals, the financial planners, the insurance agents, that professional group, that requires education to be alive to questions of financial abuse. Also to be alive to what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. If we don't teach those people, then we don't know. But the broader question is also public education. And part of that is providing support networks. Part of that is making it available for caregivers to go and learn about what they need to do. And by that, I could mean the son or daughter, the niece or nephew who's taking care, because they're taking on a whole new job. I mean, it's a personal area. My mother spent 15 years of her life after she finished teaching, taking care of older adults in her family. The thing about elder law or elder abuse or working with seniors is we're all getting older, and it's personal to everybody.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, as the percentage of the population that's in the older age groups continues to increase, we should not be surprised if we start to see a lot more problems that are associated with it.
And that's right. We're finding not just the sandwich generation, but we're going to a generation of a club sandwich, if you will, because as our older generations age and life expectancies continue, and they've been very good in North America, it's about 83 now. We're finding that there's four generations. So it tends to be other seniors caring for their even more senior family members, mm-hmm. while they themselves may be grandparents. So these are new questions that we need to look at in our society.
Just maybe very quickly, I'll introduce again our guest for this time, a part of Focus 580, Laura Watts. She's program director of the Canadian Center for Elder Law Studies at University of British Columbia in Vancouver, and is visiting here at the campus. She gave a talk yesterday. We're talking generally about elder abuse and the way that we address that. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I'm really struck by the extent to which this continues to be, in a lot of ways, a kind of a hidden problem, and about how in recent decades, maybe over the last 20, 30 years, we have become increasingly aware of the problem generally of domestic violence and more willing to talk about it. It gets more discussion in popular press. And when that happened, I think one of the things that happened was a lot of people asked this question, well, suddenly now we're talking about domestic violence, spousal abuse, child abuse. And people say, well, does that somehow mean that suddenly there's been an uptick in the incidents? And I think probably the answer to the question is no, that this was really about education and awareness. Here, though, it seems that here we're at a case where it's still much – it's not a problem that's discussed very much. It doesn't get as much discussion as other kinds of domestic violence. And again, if we're starting to hear more about it, or people who are in the law field are starting to talk about it, again, it's not necessarily a fact that suddenly that we've had this explosion of elder abuse, but that it's something that we're actually now starting to focus some attention on. Or we probably should have been all along, but you know, for some variety of reasons, maybe it just wasn't getting the attention that it should.
So there's a whole concept of aging that you pull out perfectly there. And I think that when we see this boomer generation aging, and I include myself in part of that generation, there's a different attitude towards what we're going to do in our senior years. And part of that is quite proactive. So I think it's a combination of things. As the boomers age, they see their families and their parents, and they want to be proactive about it. So a lot of taking of responsibility, which is good. There's also a sense of, as I'm taking care of my mom or dad, or I see the situation, or I happen to work in an environment where I see the situation more and more because the population is aging, my client base is also aging, I'm reflecting myself about what do I want to see and what are my concerns. So there's a bit of self-interest there. Part of it is also there's just so many more older people that are coming. And then there is this hidden issue. These questions of abuse and neglect and to a lesser degree self-neglect have always been in our society. And they are coming out more and more. And certainly a lot of the domestic violence literature and the discourse has been an inspiration. But, you know, Americans have been proactive on this issue just in terms of legislation or questioning it since about 1965. In Canada, we've lagged behind.
Really? Why, do you think?
Well, I think that Canadians generally look at many of these questions as healthcare issues, and we're a bit self-congratulatory about our healthcare system. It is a fundamental aspect of sort of the Canadian society. And I wonder sometimes whether it's not that we look at things as social problems and social supports with health solutions. Americans in the 60s, when this whole great society was being built, the issue of older Americans came up, and they passed an act called the Older Americans Act. And there's been a very strong impact of the AARP, the American Association of Retired Persons. And those lobby groups have had a great force in bringing some of these issues to the fore. In a sense, I think the Americans are ahead of us.
Oh, well, that's that's something that maybe some American policymakers would be happy to hear. To what extent, I think, again, going back to talk about domestic violence, I think one of the things that we know that certain people, depending on who they are, who are victims, are not in a very good position to speak up for themselves. Children certainly aren't. People who are victims of spousal abuse aren't always, because they feel that they're stuck, that they're trapped in the situation, and that it's very difficult to get out. And of course, one of the characteristics of the abusers is that they try to maximize control, so it makes it difficult for that person to get out. Here, and I wonder, when we're talking about elder abuse, whether part of the issue is that older people, they're frankly embarrassed about admitting to having been victimized, because that what it says is that that you've lost control, that you can't take care of yourself, and that I know for a lot of people, maybe no matter what your age, but particularly as you get older, one of the things that you really want to try to hold on to is the sense that of autonomy and of control and of being able to take care of yourself, and admitting that you may have lost that's not easy.
And that's exactly right. Another piece of that is there can be a shame about being so vulnerable. There can be a shame about thinking, you know, how have I let this happen to myself? And there's another part where it's familial. And for instance, it may be a son or daughter or a niece or nephew, something like that. There can be real shame about having raised somebody who would treat their parent that way. So the parent can take it into themselves by saying, somehow I've created this. One of the other problems that we need to look at is the question of isolation. And I think you picked up on that. Part of the cues that we can think of, and I'd be happy to have callers talk about this, is what can we as a society do to be aware of elder abuse happening next door, for instance. Part of that is being connected to your society. Part of that is talking to your neighbors. But part of it is also watching for cues. And what I hear the banking institutions saying is Mrs. Smith or Mr. Smith used to come to the bank to do their banking. And if we don't see them after a while and we see somebody else using her bank card, we might cue to think maybe Mr. or Mrs. Smith is being sort of kept quiet or not being allowed to use the phone. But as we get more technological, those cues are being missed more and more, because there doesn't tend to be quite the same connectivity with the baker and the butcher and the bank. And those people were part of the society. So it's something about the technological society. Having said that, let me just say that seniors are the number one users of internet technology. And right now, the percentage of older adults who are learning new technologies is increasing dramatically. So that may also change.
Yeah. One of the things that we've done to try to address domestic violence issues, I think particularly when it comes to children and child abuse, are creating these groups of mandated reporters, people that these are the people that come into regular contact with kids. It could be teachers, could be pediatrician, could, you know, whoever it is, that if they see any, if they see something that they suspect might be the result of abuse, they've got to say something about it. They can't just say, well, I don't know, I'm not sure, that's not my business. We said, oh, yeah, yes, it is definitely your business. When it comes to this kind of thing that we're talking about, is there anything like that, or should you think, in fact, we should have something like that?
So you've picked up on the debate of the last 20 years, just dead on. There's a real wrestling, and it's a wrestling that individual states have made. It's a wrestling that countries have made, or in Canada, different provinces have made. There are some states that feel that mandatory reporting is required, and that would be just exactly the same as the child abuse scenario. Somebody, a healthcare provider or a friend, it could be designated, depending on what state, they have certain people or certain types of jobs. And if that's the case, they must mandatorily report. Now, the contrast to that is older adults are not children. And that's the central theme. Older adults, like any adult, has a right to live at risk. And it may be that Mrs. Smith knows that her son is taking her money as a point of financial abuse. But maybe her son has always taken her money, and maybe that's a relationship that they've had, and she's chosen that relationship. And to her, connectivity with her son is more important than some aspect of her wealth. It may be that she chooses because she feels that she wants to watch out for the grandkids. There can be all kinds of complex reasons that capable adults, now I'm going to use the word capable, mm-hmm. because there's a different question with incapable. But if you're a capable adult, you have this right to live at risk. So there's three systems. The first is no mandatory reporting. Maybe you have got someone you could call, the police or a public trustee or guardian, something like that. There's a combined system where certain groups, and in some cases it might be doctors or healthcare professionals or government officials, certain groups have a mandate to report. Others may if they want. So the regular neighbor, for instance, might be able to, but the doctor would have to be able to. And then there are other systems with mandatory reporting. The new theory on that is that's a bit ham-fisted because mandatory reporting takes away individual rights of older adults, and it's a bit intrusive. I was laughing. There was the movie with Anthony Hopkins, The Fastest Indian, that came out quite recently. Yeah. And he plays a character of sort of a self-neglecting older adult who wakes up in the morning and is shabbily dressed and ill-kempt and engages in all kinds of risky behavior and like racing on the salt flats. And he is lauded in this film as being sort of cantankerous and odd, but certainly capable. And he's living at risk. There's no question in that case. Now, in a mandatory reporting system, someone would come, take him away, and engage in all kinds of protective measures. But we cheer for him in the movie because we think to him, well, he's making his choice, and he's living the life, and his life is going to be this risky behavior of racing in salt flats. So we cheer for that individualism, and that's sort of the new modern concepts. Where I come from, we have a combined system.
Mm-hmm. Well, how well do you think that that has worked in Canada?
Well, there's real questions about it. What we find is the system isn't so problematic. It's the functionality of the system. For instance, the people who are the ones who are supposed to report don't know that they're supposed to report. And if they do, they don't quite know how to do it anyway.
Yeah. Well, that would be indeed would be one of my questions, speaking just as a citizen. You know, supposing that it was a neighbor that I was concerned about. I would have no idea if I decided that I was going to try to talk to somebody. I would have no idea who to contact. I would just have no idea. I mean, I would hope that, say, if I was a physician, I would know. But just as a regular person, I would have no idea.
In different states, it's a different person that you talk to. So mm-hmm. you have to have a look. Illinois actually has a very good system. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that you have some leading lights in this area in your state. When I look across the United States, it's not difficult to see the connectivity between people engaged in what we call elder law and fairly decent law. In this state, Professor Kaplan, Richard Kaplan, who's a leading light internationally in this area. In fact, the person who arranged the Elder Law lecture, he has had, I think, a great deal of influence in terms of thinking. But I did have a neighbor in terms of real stories where I'm from, and she was an older woman. She was capable, but I hadn't seen her in about 3 weeks. And, you know, I was just about ready to call the public guardian and trustee, who in BC would be the person I would call, and they would send a social worker. And that's largely the system generally. If you have in your state some public trustee or public guardian, you can usually call them. Alternatively, you can call a health authority if you have a health authority in your area. Some people will just call the police and say, can you send someone around? Having said that, it's quite shocking to have a police officer show up at your door. And in this particular case, I did what I think I would recommend to most people if they don't think it's too dangerous. I went and knocked on the door. And she was just fine, but she had been away.
So there was no problem at all.
There was no problem at all. But I looked at her, and I knew that she was at risk of falling, and she was not based on age, but just based on her ability. She had a walker, and I was concerned for her. And when I knocked on the door, she had a healthy tan because she had been away with her daughter.
Okay, well, so that story turned out well, but it could just have turned out badly.
It could
as well.
And in that case, I think it shows that if we really reach out into our networks, a lot of this, I always say, is based on good communication. And as a lawyer, I say that when things get bad, there's law. But when things are good, there's communication.
Yeah, at least that's what it should be. That's what it should be. We're about our midpoint here. Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Laura Watts. She is Program Director of the Canadian Center for Elder Law Studies at University of British Columbia in Vancouver. She organized the first Canadian conference on elder law that was held last fall. She's also been involved in creating a peer-reviewed Canadian Journal of Elder Law. Before going to the Canadian Center for Elder Law, she was an attorney. She handled sexual abuse and fiduciary-related cases with a law firm in Vancouver. She is a barrister and solicitor educated in Canada, visiting here to give a lecture. This is the Anne F. Baum Elder Law Lecture. That was yesterday at the law school. And here this morning we're talking about elder law, and questions are welcome. Or I'm talking elder abuse. I guess if you want to talk about elder law, we could do that too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. When the legal system does get involved, How does that go? And when you look at that, either in Canada or the United States, do you think that it works well, or is there potential that there might be problems?
Oh, there's potential for problems. Mm-hmm. I don't know anyone who would answer that it works well in almost any field. But it does tend to depend on a few elements. And no matter what state you're in, no matter what province you're in, the elements are the same. The first is, can the older adult get some kind of legal representation, some kind of access to justice, which is not too difficult? Now, here's the trick. If you're in a situation of financial abuse, someone's mortgaged your home when you didn't know it, somebody has drained your financial assets, or someone has stamped you with the term incapable and is using your power of attorney, you can't get your money. And if you can't get your money, it's pretty hard to hire a lawyer. Alternatively, if you are stamped incorrectly with, if you will, the incapability claim, lawyers aren't allowed to be instructed. So there's a bit of a structural problem there. So you have to sort of figure out how in each state you might work with that. And there have been legislative responses to it. The big problem that I see is that older adults can't get an easy access to justice or can't get a lawyer. And because of these questions being quite related to poverty law, older adults certainly are at risk for poverty much more than other adults who've been working. It tends to be both gendered and it tends to be hidden. So by say gendered, I mean that the largest percentage of poor people, both in Canada and the United States, are older women who are living on their own, who've been widowed or divorced. They typically haven't had a chance to save into pension plans or 401ks, and they typically haven't earned some kind of an adequate social security net on their own. It also happens to be that women live longer. So what is the problem there? We need to think about if there are legal remedies, if you have to go to the law, can that person get a voice?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the question would be if it, with any particular jurisdiction, if you would have the resources and if you think this is an important problem, then you have someone who's special, someone within your local prosecutor's office, whose special responsibility it is to handle these kind of cases.
And a lot of states have responded with sort of a similar system that a domestic violence has in the past. In Canada, what my talk was on was that Canada hasn't taken a criminal justice response. It hasn't taken it to the criminal code. And I was trying to explore some reasons why Canada didn't prosecute in the same way that the Americans have been quite quick to prosecute. Mm-hmm. In fact, in some states, and I'll pick out Florida or California, Arizona, and for that matter, Illinois, there are very specific criminal elder abuse charges, not just general charges of assault or theft or fraud, which is what we do in Canada, but something that the Americans have said is doing this to older adults, or in some jurisdictions, they just call it vulnerable adults. It doesn't matter the age. It's about the vulnerability. Doing some kind of assault or theft or chemical abuse, et cetera, is somehow different to this group of people in the same way it might be different in a spousal relationship or different to a child. And these American systems have pulled that out and said, we want to talk about this specifically. In Canada, we haven't taken that approach.
Hmm. Well, do you think that the American approach is makes more sense somehow?
Well, I wonder about that. And part of my lecture was trying to figure out why Canada hasn't taken this sort of criminal approach of criminalizing elder abuse as a sort of specific charge. Mm-hmm. And part of it is, I think, structural. Canada has one set of laws for the entire country for criminal matters, so it's harder to change those laws. We tend to also look at things in terms of sentencing. So we'll charge with assault, but when it comes down to sentencing before the judge, the prosecutor might make arguments that it's so much worse because the person was 90 or frail or a disabled adult in some fashion. It depends. What I want to see in Canada is a vigorous debate, and we haven't started it yet.
Hmm. So here in the United States, as you know, I'm sure there can be a big difference in state law from one state to the next. And it can be a really sort of contentious, controversial issue, this idea. Well, what should federal law be on any given matter? And to what extent should there be one standard for the entire United States? Or to what extent should we just say to states, look, you in your state legislature, you in your government, you decide how you want to deal with this from one state to the next. In Canada, as you say, there's much more uniformity from one province to the next because there is a strong kind of national law, even though I'm sure in Canada, people in the East and the West feel just as much as they're in different countries almost as we do here in the United States. But there it gives you an opportunity to sort of to look at both of those things and say, well, is one really better? Is the other really better? I'm sure there are some cases where here people in the United States, for example, would say, well, depending on what it is you're talking about, whether it's this, whether it's environmental law, whatever you're talking about, they would say, no, we really need to have a strong system of federal law so that it's the same from one state to the next. And then I'm sure there are other people that say, no, what's really important is the states have to do this themselves. It sounds as if in Canada that's also something that is a subject for argument and that there really is no sort of agreement about, even though Canada is sort of more one way, and the United States is maybe a little bit more the other way. There's not such agreement there really on whether one or the other is better.
Well, it's funny. During my talk, I said one of the reasons I think the underlying principles that Canada hasn't rushed to sort of a legislative response in terms of criminal law or hasn't gone out and prosecuted in quite the same way on elder abuse that the Americans have might come down to sort of founding principles of our countries. And I was joking and I said, you know, Americans fought a bloody revolutionary war to free themselves from tyranny, and that's how you became a country. We just asked nicely. And I think it has a lot to do with a little bit of how we take different approaches. Now, having said that, I think Canadians find it a bit baffling that you can be having a totally legal action in one state, and if you cross the border to 15 feet, what you do is criminal. And so in terms of our criminal law, it's the same across the country in almost all ways. There's bits and pieces where I'll disclaim, being the lawyer that I am, but it's almost all the same ways. Where provinces have the purview are in things like health and education and guardianship and strategies to deal with things like elder abuse. And so the American system being so strongly state-based in this area, one of the advantages to the American system is, for instance, the state of Illinois has said, we don't want to have the scourge of elder abuse in our state. What we are going to do then is a package of things. Part of the package of things will be to make some changes in education, which is somewhat state-based. We're going to make some changes in how our health delivery systems might be done with public health. We're going to make some changes to how our police force works, and we're going to make some changes in our penal codes, in how our state law is. So it's all in one area. And in a sense, that's why I think you see states with more coherent packages. In Canada, with this division of power, it's not so easy. And so what I think we've seen in Canada is certain provinces have taken a very strong stand, but they only have purview over some things. And one of the things they do not have purview over is criminal
matters. Yeah, the criminal law. Well, in Ottawa, in the national, in the parliament, is this something that, are there members who have chosen to make this an issue?
The way that our system works is, frankly, unless you actually have the leader of the party, in this case, our prime minister, analogous to your president, unless he or she decides that she wants a bill through, i.e. make a bill into law, it's really not going to get there. Private members' bills don't have the weight that they have here in terms of independence. That's just a function of more elected officials here in the United States. I was having an interesting conversation about this yesterday, and one of the professors at the law school, Professor Bross, brought up, he thought it also provides a bit of American grandstanding opportunities that might not have follow through. So that's an interesting point. Americans have a greater sense of their ability to talk to their local representatives and pass law as a statement saying, we're going to pass this law. He brought up whether or not there were the teeth to follow through.
Mm-hmm. Let me just add, I'm not sure that I've mentioned enough or hardly at all the telephone number here, because I certainly do want to involve people in the conversation if there are listeners who have questions, comments. The number, as always here, Champaign Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. And again, our guest here this morning is Laura Watts. She is Program Director of the Canadian Center for Elder Law Studies at University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And we're talking about elder abuse. She's here to give a lecture, or did indeed give a lecture yesterday at the law school on the subject. So questions are indeed welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-9455. Something that I think that you touched on in your talk was, and I expect that for some people that it's a real concern, is that is it possible in any way that the system that we've tried to set up to deal with elder abuse might make things worse? And I can imagine a situation where if a complaint is made and the authorities are involved, but there isn't real good follow-through, that if there indeed is a malicious abuser, he or she might not take very kindly to that, and it could result in increased abuse instead of less.
Well, that's just right. And I'd be interested from hearing from your listeners if they've had any personal stories that they would like to share, because part of what I do is listen. And so if you're out there and you have had an experience, I would love to hear from you about that personal experience. So much of this is personal. I had a story that happened not that long ago, and it was a woman who was in an abusive situation, and she left at age 79, and there wasn't the support network for her. And she ended up going to a transition house, and because of the inadequate supports and just bad systems, she ended up going back, at which point she was beaten so badly by her 83-year-old husband with a cane that she was then sent to hospital, and she suffered a lot from a result of those injuries. And these are questions that are deeply, deeply personal to us. I also had another case where it was a matter where a mortgage was taken out. It was in joint name. It was always supposed to be for the older adult. In this particular case, it was a mother and son. He'd mortgaged it to the hilt and then left. And she had no support system. She had no more money. He had taken absolutely everything. And because it was in joint name, well, he could do that legally. Could he do it morally or ethically? Clearly not.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that, you know, now it is, I don't know if this is necessarily the reason, but I think there are probably more situations where we have people who are caregivers for older, probably in most cases it's older parents we're talking about here, who have various kinds of powers of attorney to make financial decisions for that individual, someone who then legally can sign checks, pay bills, take care of things like that. And certainly there are a lot of situations where that is absolutely necessary, and it's really important, because if you have someone who, for example, for reason of illness, can't do that for themselves, well, you've got to have somebody who is in a position to be able to do that. At the same time, though, I would expect that there is the potential for abuse, and that at least on the face of it, it would be perfectly legal, because this person has been given in law the authority to do that, to make financial decisions, to do things with that person's money, to sign their checks, to make decisions about their health care. Maybe that's a whole separate issue, but particularly in the financial realm, and that there might not be a whole lot you could do if that person says, "Well, look, you know, I've got the power of attorney here. I'm just doing what I consider to be the appropriate thing to do here, and maybe it's none of your business, or maybe you don't really understand the situation. But the fact of the matter is that the law is on my side."
It's really hard. Powers of attorney worry me. I know that they are important financial instruments. I understand that. But they do worry me, because it does mean that someone else can sign your name. Somebody else can have enormous power. And depending on what state you're in or what province you're in, they can do all kinds of things. Now, again, depending on what state or province you're in, there are some remedies. You can try to get your money back. The problem with that type of thing is usually the money's gone.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, Ontario, the entire police force of Ontario has identified theft of monies or financial abuse under a power of attorney as the number one new area of concern for them for the next 10 years.
Really?
They're really worried about it, because it can be done maliciously, as you've said. And in a case, those sometimes are even easier to deal with. The harder situation is when there's the feelings of entitlement or just a misunderstanding about the duties of an attorney. It can be very difficult. If your roof is falling in and you have a pot of money that's sitting there, it might be under a power of attorney or it might be under a joint account, and you look at it and you think, well, you know, maybe I'm going to inherit anyway. Just because you think that, you can't spend the monies. Having said that, the roof is caving in and things are pretty gray, and maybe you're going to borrow it and maybe you intend to put it back. But these things are very difficult. And really, that is an abuse. But there are those challenging situations of need.
Yeah. Well, I'm just now curious, where you mentioned that this was in Ontario, where the authorities have decided that this is going to be a primary of concern. Is that prospective? That is, they're looking ahead and they're worried that it's going to become a problem, or they've already seen that it is a problem?
They've already seen it as a problem. And they've done the math on the demographics, and they see it's a problem. They see more and more of it happening. They're able to track their numbers. And just informally, we haven't got the rest of our numbers in many other parts of the province. But, you know, in the United States, they've been collecting data since about 1965 on areas of elder abuse. And there are numbers, and they're shocking. And when you look at the fact that the population is aging at such a rapid pace, you mm-hmm. know it's only going to be more.
Well, this I find interesting and obviously of something that would be of concern, that should be a particular problem where someone was taking advantage of someone. You can see there would be one set of clear cases, someone maybe taking advantage of someone financially, where clearly this is criminal activity. Clearly it's against the law. But that you would have these other cases where you might have some kind of legal instrument like a power of attorney backing that person up, and so that they would fall back on that. So either, you know, maybe it's malicious, maybe it's not, but that by actually having that instrument and thinking, well, this is actually a good thing, you know, we've set up this situation, that you actually would be creating a problem that didn't exist before. Now, maybe, again, this has something to do with numbers. And if we have more older people, then there's a possibility we might see that situation more. But I'm very struck by this idea that something that on the face of it should seem to be a good idea and a prudent thing to do could, like having powers of attorney, could indeed turn out to be something that actually created a problem or made a problem worse.
Temptation's a hard thing, and need in combination with temptation makes things even harder.
Yeah. Let me again just tell people who are listening that we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Laura Watts. She's program director of the Canadian Center for Elder Law Studies at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And questions are welcome. We do have someone here, I think, ready to go. And if somebody else wants to call in, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And the caller is in Urbana, and it's line number 1. Hello.
I was wondering if you could speak to the issue of abuse being intergenerational in our family. You know, my brother witnessed my father abusing my mother, and then when my mother was older and he was taking care of her, he was sort of repeating history. And I had to put my foot down and have her remove him from the house until his behavior got remediated. And then he was able to come back and be a caregiver and maintain his cool, so to speak. But that was one of those, like, crux issues of, like, how do you stop it when it's intergenerational?
And you're absolutely right. Abuse is one of those things that is passed down through the family, through systems. And if somebody has been the victim of abuse, we know the numbers that they are so much more likely to be abusers themselves. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, education and support for you as well, because you've been in a situation where you've been experiencing caregiver stress and worry. I'm sure that you could speak to how that felt for you, but you're quite right. When abuse is in a family or in a system, it perpetuates itself.
Well, for me, it was mainly because it was long distance. You know, my brother and my mother lived thousands of miles away. And, you know, you just sort of have to try and work with everybody's foibles in the whole situation, you know, because my brother was just getting overwhelmed with the caregiving, you know, because it was taking so much time and energy. And the way we finally resolved it is when my mom needed to be in hospice, I went out and stayed with her for 4.5 months till she passed away because, you know, I had the better ability and skills to be able to do that than anybody else in my family. But that was just a blessing to be able to do that. A lot of people don't have that opportunity.
Thanks for sharing that story with us. These kinds of stories are things that we need to talk about. And so talking about it on the air and talking about it on the radio, that's all part of that communication. And so you sharing it with me is part of that whole communication support.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's go to line number 2. Hello.
Hi. How are you? I think your guest's crucial question here, the crucial statement is about how abuse is defined, the ostensible abuse of the person just calling versus the subtlety. I had a friend who died about 5 years ago who was in his late 70s when I met him, and he became a little, I would say almost, he started losing his ability to remember things and stuff like that, and then he would start mentioning things to me because I would see him probably about 2 or 3 times a week, and we were not related, and he'd talk about his wife, like she was stealing stuff from him, stuff like that. So I wasn't quite sure what to do in that situation because his wife seemed to be quite emotionally and intellectually there, you know what I mean by that? And so he ended up dying a few years later. But it's a real interesting subject to me because how, in some states, I'm sure it's defined obviously, like, you know, the person's in a nursing home, maltreatment, people avoid seeing people and visiting and all this kind of stuff. And when my mother died many years ago, she would be looking at me and say, "Who are you?" and things like that when she was in hospice and in and out of hospices. So it's a very sensitive subject. And could your guest address that sort of how it's defined state by state or even by areas? And I'm just very curious about this situation. Thank you.
Okay.
That's a great question. How you do define abuse, it depends on a couple of things. The first is, legislation is always reactive. It's rarely proactive. And so it's hard to understand. I mentioned earlier, for instance, chemical abuse. That's fairly recent in the literature. And even 5 years ago, 10 years ago, it wouldn't have sprung to the minds of people. Well, in certain jurisdictions, it's clearly defined as an area. So if you went into a nursing home and you could say, show me all the medications for this person that I'm caring for and tell me what they do. And you find out, for instance, that they've got them on something, which like a lorazepam or a Valium, something. You ask, why are they on that? And there's no good reason. And then you find out that many, many people are on that. You might start questioning, you know, is that abuse? And you have the legislation to look to and say, but we see right here, it looks like chemical abuse and I have a remedy. What you point to is this very challenging area of capacity. When you're in a situation of declining capacity, which is really quite the common one, it's rare that you're hit by a bus and you move straight into a coma and you're capable 1 minute and you're not capable the next. Certainly from my family's personal stories, we have Alzheimer's, and that's done one of the reasons that I got into this area is, you know, I lived it for many, many years. It's very challenging because one of the areas of declining capacity can sometimes be paranoia. And that's just a natural chemical response. You're not blaming anybody for it. But in some people, certain dementias do come. And it involves itself in things like stealing or being kept away. And it's extremely worrying. And what can we do about that? Again, it depends state by state. I think here is a great place for social workers to get involved. If you have social workers in your local area or people who are any kind of dementia training, sometimes your local Alzheimer's Society, if it is that type of a dementia, getting some help on that point can be very, very helpful. The advocacy groups are just excellent in this area, and it might be that you can connect to one of your advocacy groups and get some caregiving information about, you know, what do I do here in my state? But you're quite right. The questions of what is abuse is an area that, you know, we talk about all the time. And what it comes down to is we all want to make sure that we're all treated fairly and justly, and we want to keep that connectivity. But I would say sometimes the legislation is not the best route. Sometimes social work, sometimes advocacy groups, turning to them can be helpful.
Yeah. You know, we're just about at the end of the time. Here in the United States, I think we're just starting now to talk about the how, with the increase in the older segment of the population, how we should expect the costs associated with caring for them to grow astronomically. And I think that more and more people, you know, in the policy arena are saying, we are not ready and we'd better get ready because it's going to be huge. And it seems like we're still sort of at that talking stage. I'm not sure how tuned in people are to it. In Canada, I'm assuming that you would be facing the same sort of problem. Is that an issue that's really on the table for politicians and policymakers?
It is. There's a lot of mythology around what it costs to age. But the numbers actually show that, yes, it's true that the oldest of the old, sort of 80s and 90s, take up proportionately much more of the health budget. But having said that, a lot of it has to do with how we plan very poorly. If we don't put the social infrastructures in, if we don't make living at home with healthcare support, caregiver support, hospice and palliative care, if we don't look to those questions and put the money there, they end up in acute care. And that's what costs when you're in the hospital beds. And that's not where people want to be. It's not where older adults want to be. It's not where their families want to be. It's not where the hospitals think is appropriate. So some of that has to do with making some plans for now. So Canada is looking into it. But just like here, no one likes to think it's going to happen to them. I think there's some ageism in the whole debate.
Yeah. Well, I think at about that point, we will finish with our thanks to our guest, Laura Watts. She's program director of the Canadian Center for Elder Law Studies at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. I know that they do have a website, so if you're interested in this issue, you'd like to see what they are all about, some of the information is there. And there are, I know, many, many links to different sites that have different information on this issue. So you know, you can go to their website and from there go on.
And we're at www.ccels, short for Canadian Center for Elder Law Studies, ccels.ca. And let me just take a moment to thank the law school here at University of Illinois and the Dean of the Law School, Professor Kaplan. As well, let me just take a moment to thank the Ann Baum Lecture Series and the Baum family in particular for having me down.
Well, thank you very much for being here.